Welcome to the best of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Well, our guest tonight is perhaps one of the sprightliest octogenarians you're ever likely to meet. For several decades, she has worked at the heart of the Melbourne food industry and was recently recognised for her service to the hospitality sector and promotion of Chinese cuisine by receiving Queen's Birthday honours. She's arguably Australia's very first celebrity chef. She's an author, a TV presenter, a lifetime Australia Day ambassador, and to some, she's known by her nickname, the Empress of Chinatown. It is my pleasure to welcome to Great Australian Lives, Elizabeth Chong, A.M.
That sounds pretty posh.
Yes.
I have to say, yes, I'm fairly chuffed every time I see that now.
And on the envelopes, on the mail that you get.
That's right. And you have to stop yourself from thinking, you know, that you're more important than you really are.
Oh. The first time you got a letter in the mail that was addressed to Elizabeth Chong, A.M.
That's right.
How did you feel?
I thought, oh my gosh. That's something special, you know, because you think you live in this country for so long, all your life, and now you're a special Australian, you know, and have AM means you belong, you're a member of Australia, you know, and
that's,
it's good. And do you know that came from a student who I had memories of, but had not thought about for... Well, she said she was a student in 1962, and she wrote to me, and the envelope was Elizabeth Chong AM, and that was even more special because she was a student of, that's 57 years ago.
Wow, it was someone who you've had a profound impact on.
Must have, you know, and I thought, here she is writing to me like that, and it was such a lovely little card.
Did you frame the envelope? Are you going to keep that first letter?
I've kept it, so good. Maybe I will frame it.
Yeah, that's... being recognised on the Queen's Birthday honours, I mean, as you said, you now feel like a special Australian. You already were, of course. But what an achievement for this to happen now in your life. I mean, how special.
It is special because I've just devoted my whole life, I suppose, to almost being a missionary, you know, of my own food, my own culture, without meaning to be. And I was just doing something that was fairly natural.
Yes.
It was just a natural love and a passion. And Laura, I like being with people. And I think that's probably the thing that kept me going, that I was always interacting and talking with people and I could get their reaction back. And it's very rewarding to be a teacher.
Yes, I can imagine.
And especially when I get a letter from a student 57 years ago, I think, that really makes it worthwhile.
Were you surprised when it happened?
I was surprised. Different ones had said it a few times about it, and I used to just say, oh, don't be silly. You know, I just do what I do.
Yeah.
And then I went to collect some mail from my old office thinking, oh, well, you know, it hasn't been redirected and I'll better check. And I had a little bundle in my hand, but this letter was thick. Mm-hmm. And I said, I wonder what's maybe some advertising stuff.
Hopefully not a bill.
Well, they're usually flat with a window, you know.
Yes, oh yeah, you always know.
And this was a fat envelope. And
right.
I picked that one up first. And I looked at the insignia on the front, you know, and it was the Governor General's, the crown on the front. I thought,
what have I done wrong?
I'm in
big trouble
if
now.
If it had come from the police department, yes, I would say so. But I thought, no. This might be just a nice invitation to a cocktail party or something because I'm an Australia Day ambassador.
Of course.
And then when I opened up, actually I was in the shop next door by the time I'd opened it up.
Yeah.
And I did what I'm not supposed to do because you're supposed to be confidential.
Of course.
But I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And I opened it up in front of her. I said, gee, this is interesting. Mm. I said to the girl who owns the shop, the lady who owns the shop. I said, oh, my God. I said, look. And I said, I've been given the Order of Australia. And she celebrated with me. She hugged me. And then right on the end it said, keep this strictly confidential.
You had to gag her until it happened.
Oh, yeah. And I thought, oh, they'll already disqualify me. But I've done the wrong thing.
So were you shaking in your boots?
I was shaking then. I didn't believe that. And then I couldn't wait to ring my son and my daughters, and, you know. And then they were all excited too.
And you, you know, I mean, you're always in demand. You're a very popular lady in Australia. But since this happened, you've been, it's been a busy schedule, hasn't it?
It has. I thought, I don't know whether it was because of the award. I suppose it is. You know, I've just had funny things come to my attention. I'm sort of going to realise almost a childhood, a bucket list thing. I never thought it would ever eventuate because at this age, why should it? But I've always thought it would be wonderful to be on stage, you know, to be to go on the theatre, just once to feel it.
Yeah.
And at one time I thought I'll do amateur dramatics just to see if it's good fun.
Yeah.
And my granddaughter's an opera singer. And when I see her on stage, I think, well, she's doing it. I don't need to do that because she's a theatre person. And I've just got this little offer from a Sydney company, and they want me to do a little bit of theatre. It's unusual, but it's very nice. And so I am going to be treading the boards, and I will go on tour.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Melbourne, Sydney, Adelaide, and maybe Hong Kong and Singapore.
That is incredible.
That's right. I've just got to have the stamina.
Is there anything you can't do?
Maybe they'll find out I can't do it. I don't know. But I'm going to give it a go. This is my style. I always give it a go.
Yeah, of course. And that's what a great attitude to have. Now, on that, you are, in inverted commas, retired. Mm-hmm. But you're not really, are you?
No,
you
keep very busy. I'm not the retiring type.
No. So what are you filling your time with other than just deciding that you're going to be on stage and achieving that? What else does Elizabeth Chong get up to?
I think that's fairly demanding because they want rehearsals and talks and things. But I still have some interest in my own work. I have Elizabeth Chong Gourmet Club.
Yes.
Which involves 60 to 80 people.
Incredible.
And I take them out to dinner 4 times a year. And so that's coming up, and that takes, it's like organising a little wedding every time I do it. But that's
some
very
people
rewarding.
Faint at the thought of organising a little wedding often.
Yeah. That's the same thing, you know, they want to sit with somebody and they don't want to sit with somebody else. And I've got to organise the food and the entertainment, and it's good fun. So that's still going. And I have my family.
Family would keep you busy. Yeah. Their grandchildren and things now.
That's right.
Oh, you mentioned your granddaughter's an opera singer.
That's right,
incredible. And, you must be very proud.
Oh, yes, she's pretty good. The others are all lovely, and we have a lot of celebrations, you know, different ones, birthdays, it happens almost every month or two.
Now, you, as we know, are a very hard worker. You've got a great work ethic. Do you think that has defined the person that you are, that we know, Elizabeth Chong?
Yeah, I think that may be one of the core values that I have, that I probably got that from my mum. She was a physical hard worker, but I'm not so much physical that way, but I do believe in putting your best foot forward, you know, all the time. And I don't, as I said, I hardly ever say no.
Yeah.
If somebody asks me to do something, professionally or just personal, I will say, yes, I can do it. And so that keeps me on the move, and whether it's a work ethic or not, it sort of ends up being that way, you know, that you're always going about doing things.
Do you think that's opened doors for you along the way, being, you know, taking every opportunity? Because some people talk about being given opportunities, but you make them for yourself, don't you? And that sort of...
I think probably. Yeah. I think that's it. And you say, oh, I don't know how that happened, but then probably I made it happen in some way.
Yeah.
But one thing leads to the other, doesn't it?
Yeah. And you mentioned your mum being a great influence on, you know, your work ethic. What was she like when you were younger?
Always remember her as being a worker, not one of those sort of pampered ladies. Mm-hmm. You know, as some of the Chinese women of her generation, their husbands supported them very well, as indeed my father did.
Yes. But she had her sleeves rolled up.
And you could find her in a tree. You know, she would be pruning the tree herself.
She was hands-on.
She was hands-on, and she'd be digging in the garden. And my father was a great gardener, and he'd grow lovely rhododendrons and roses. And Mum would be on her her knees, and she'd be planting spring onions and garlic and cabbages amongst the rhododendrons and the roses, you know.
Now, you were born in China, weren't you?
I was. Yeah, I was. I spent the first 3 years of my life in a little rural village in South China.
Yep.
I don't remember any of it, that, though, because I came out when I was three.
Yes.
I have just earliest memories probably after I landed in Australia, not too long after. And I remember being terrified of Australian people.
Really?
Yeah, because, especially because I think one of our neighbours had very white hair, and she used to pick me up and hug me because I was a little three or four year old, Chinese 3 year old.
Yeah.
And she used to just hug and squeeze me, and she had this white hair and ample bosom. And she smelt of cabbage.
Oh, no.
Remember that? And I would shriek in terror. And I can remember that. Then I got to love her. But but my mum said I used to run every time I saw an Australian person for a while. Because all those attributes are just unknown to a little Chinese child.
Yeah, yeah.
We go grey, I guess, but not that lovely silver colour.
Yes, yeah.
And I'd say, guai lo, meaning little ghost.
It doesn't sound like she was that little.
No, well, guai lo is actually, it's worse than that. It means foreign devil.
Oh.
Yeah, but they don't really mean it that way. It's just
you were a little girl,
foreign,
of course.
That's all, yes. Yeah. And I didn't think she was normal because she had those. She had the
especially
colour.
To a little girl.
Yes, and being so big. Yeah,
yes. Mm. And there's quite a story to your family's move here to Australia, isn't there?
There is really, yeah.
What brought you here and how did it happen?
My life has always been divided into two parts, and that was simply because my grandfather goes back, the story goes back to 1853, and my grandfather, at the age of 17, left China to look for gold in Victoria.
I was just about to say, when you said that era, I was about to say gold rush days, and I thought, shut up, Laura.
Yeah. Well, he was only a young boy.
Yeah.
And would you believe my grandfather stayed in Victoria in a little town called Wigunya? Do you know? I have heard of it.
Yes, yep.
It's a lovely little place. Mm-hmm. It used to be quiet like it is now. It used to be a bustling port.
Of course,
It's next to Rutherglen, you know, and I think a lot of people know Rutherglen. And All Saints Winery is up at Wigunya. And he settled in Wigunya and at 17. And he stayed there till he was nearly 60. So it makes him almost, an Australian pioneer.
Yeah.
So he had his six children were born in Wigunya.
Wow.
And I'm told that he was a bachelor until he was about 56 or 57. Officially a bachelor, probably not, but because
on paper he was a bachelor.
I have a feeling that I've got some relatives around there with with blue eyes.
We're calling all listeners in Wigunya.
But then when he was about 57 or 58, I believe, he thought he should have a Chinese wife.
Right.
To have...
Knuckle down and get serious.
His line would carry on, you see. Yep. So my grandmother was chosen in China, and she came out on a boat from Canton, those days. She must have had a chaperone, I guess, but she came out as an 18-year-old and he was 58.
Mm, wow.
But I believe she was considered to be very lucky, you know, to be chosen to come to the land of the New Gold Mountain, as Australia was called.
Yep.
So she came and they had their family in Wigunya, and my dad is fourth born. And being fourth born, though, he never got to go to school as his older brothers and sister did, because when he was five, my grandpa was now like 65. And he decided it was time to go back home and, in the words of the Chinese word, bury your bones, you know, in your own soil. So they packed up and they went back, and my dad then and his brothers spent their I suppose teenage years, I guess, being schooled in the little village back in China. A pretty scant education, but and I believe my grandfather built one of the biggest houses in the village because he had done well in Victoria.
Yes.
He had been a very successful person in Wigunya.
Yep.
And then when the boys, that's my father and my uncles then, were teenagers, they decided they should return to Australia because they were ABCs, Australian-born Chinese, very privileged.
Yes.
Meaning they could own property and go into business.
Yep.
And China always has a history of famine and suffering and civil wars. And so, you know, they thought, well, Australia was the best place to have a future.
Beautiful.
So they came back to Australia and my dad established some very important and successful businesses. Mm-hmm. And he didn't wait till he was 58. When he was 23, he decided he should get married.
Yeah.
So he went back to China.
Yep.
And my mum was chosen for him. That's mm-hmm. match made.
Yes.
And she's told me some delightful stories about how that happened.
Did she like him to begin with?
Yes, she did.
Oh, good,
she did.
Good.
She said she had her girlfriend and they were in the next room. Mm-hmm. And they opened the curtains a bit because Dad was being interviewed by my mum's mum.
Right.
And I asked my father later on how did he choose my mother with the matchmaker? What did he say to the matchmaker? Uh-huh. And he said he wanted a woman who was strong. He must have thought he needed her as a worker. Anyway.
Your mum was up the tree pruning at that stage, so that she'll do.
I think he had a vision of that, that she should be strong and healthy mm-hmm. and not too beautiful.
Not too beautiful,
because I think that's trouble. Yep.
No, we need to keep her in line.
That's right. And I thought, that's disgusting, Dad. That's terrible.
Oh.
But Mum said she was a bit excited because when she peeped through, she said, oh, he's nice looking. Because my dad was quite handsome.
Yeah.
But most importantly, she said, he looks kind. I think that was very, very, what do you call it, astute of her, because he was always a very gentle man. And she said, I think he'll do.
It's a whirlwind. He'll do.
talk about whirlwind courtships.
Yeah.
2 days later, she's married.
Wow.
In the village, you know. She says yes, and that's it. And eventually got, I suppose, it took a couple of years to get a visa for her.
It was difficult for her, wasn't it? Because when she came to Australia, she had to actually return to China because
of
the white Australia
policy. Yeah, but she did spend quite a few years here because my eldest sister, Ruby, and my eldest brother Tom were born and Mum was pregnant with Irene, the third child, and they lived in Carlton and Dad was, you know, was a pretty good businessman and Mum was busy looking after the children and everything was happy. And then I think the White Australia sort of reared its head again and it was decided that all Chinese-born people had to return to China. And that meant Mum, not my brother and sister, not my father, but Mum. So Dad then sold the little house they had in Grattan Street, Carlton, and he sailed back to China with her and settled her back in his father's village with his mother. My sister Irene was born en route in Hong Kong.
Wow.
And then when they got back to the little village in Guangzhou, 2 years later I was born. My dad just did just commute backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
And then it still took another 3 years after that for him to get a visa for my mother and me. And then at that time, that was 1934, the whole family, that's Grandma, Mum, Ruby, Tom, Irene and myself, we sailed into Port Melbourne.
Beautiful.
1934.
Finally.
And I don't remember that day.
And you haven't looked back.
And I haven't looked back, no.
Well, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals and there is plenty more to come with Elizabeth Chong.
You're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals. Tonight we are celebrating the life of Elizabeth Chong, who has been honoured for her role in promoting Chinese cuisine in Australia and until very recently ran Melbourne's very first Chinese cooking school. Now, Elizabeth, we've talked all about your arrival in Australia, the hurdles your parents faced before, you know, really calling Australia and Melbourne home for good. But once things got really settled, and even before then, really, your family really has thrived here, haven't they?
They have. That would be because of my father's character. He was a man blessed, I think I could almost say, with Chinese wisdom and Western enterprise. He just
good
had
combination.
The best. It was that's a great
fusion.
That's the most wonderful combination that you could get, you know.
Yeah.
He taught us always that Australia was our home, even though he was raised as a child in China and he never learnt really to speak English well, but he said, this is our home, mm-hmm. and you are to consider yourselves Australian, and my Australian girlfriends were all allowed to bring them home. Even I was allowed to go away for weekends to my girlfriend's mm-hmm. homes. Mm-hmm. He never put any restrictions on us, as a lot of the other Chinese families did, you know, because they were nervous of outside influences.
Yes.
My father said, no, we don't want the old Chinese ways, which would be more encumbrances than they are of benefit, because this is Australia.
He embraced Australian
culture. He embraced it and taught us to love Australia. And he loved Australia.
As you do.
Funny thing, Nora, I went back to China in 1976 with my mother. My father had passed away. And I thought she would be so happy to be back for where she came from. But she kept saying, but I come from Melbourne. I live in Melbourne. She told everybody, she said, Melbourne is my home.
Yeah, she's proud.
Yeah, and I thought that she would suddenly feel at home because she never learned to speak the language. Mm. I said, now, Mum, you can talk all day long and not worry because, you know, everybody speaks the same dialect. And,
yes.
But in Australia, she always had to have me or my sisters to translate. And she started, would you believe, to say a few English words. And
irony.
I didn't know she knew.
That is so funny.
It is.
Your earliest memories here, do they involve the cuisine that Melburnians and Australians have become so, you know, well acquainted with because of you?
That's right, yes, I think so. It was inevitable, I think, that I ended up in the food business.
Yeah.
I had not intended to do. When I was at school, I had grand aspirations that I would be an opera singer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
There you go.
A concert pianist, a journalist, anything.
So you've always had those sort of performance running in your blood.
And it sort of propelled me into what I do now, I guess. Food was something that my father did as a business, and there was always cooks coming and going from our home. And
sorry to interrupt, but for those listening, we are talking to Elizabeth Chong, and I've got to say, your dad secretly is my hero.
Oh, I know
you would have heard this a million times before, but the inventor of the very first commercial dim sim.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I'm glad Melburnian would want to kiss him if he was around.
Well, I did want to put a monument up to him.
They should have.
And I thought, oh, I couldn't bear that.
Can I just say,
pineapple, you know, the big dim sim.
Can I just very quickly, I want to tell you, I lived overseas for a few years where you couldn't get dim sims, me and my partner. And we had a hankering so badly.
I know.
That we Googled how to make them. We wanted fried ones. We went and bought a deep fryer and made them. There's a guy who'd sung in a Australian accent and song on YouTube how to make the dim sim, and we actually made them in our kitchen in America and fried them up, and they were almost perfect, and it felt like home.
I know, and it's only that marks you as a Victorian.
I know because
I think, I don't know what year was, in the 60s or something, when a lot of Aussies went to live in Earl's Court in London. And I used to get letters from people to say, please
send
tell
me
us
a
how
dim
to make
sim.
It. And I did
it's
send
amazing.
Some, I did send some dim sims. They didn't miss the pie, they missed the dim sims.
Yeah, we had such a strong hankering. Anyway, back to you. Food was a big part of your life because of Dad, and obviously he's a hero.
I knew that it was something that we revered, but I never thought I would spend my days and nights around a wok myself.
And you sort of came on when you got married, didn't it?
Yes.
In terms of really getting your sleeves rolled up.
I trained as a primary school teacher in the end, which I loved teaching. So that put me in good stead for my future, I guess, without knowing it.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I can't go back to school teaching. I had four small children. The baby, Richard, was only 2 months old, but I wanted to do something. I'd counted up how many nappies I'd washed and how many bottles of milk I'd made. I thought, I've got to do something.
Something
I really
else.
Want to. And it was a result of doing a lot of charity work. I had been out on that circuit just cooking without wanting to, really.
Yeah.
People were asking me, how do you do this and how do you do that? And fundraising, you know, and they said, can you give us a demonstration? So I was doing that. And in the end, a group of school teachers actually got together and they said, there's 10 of us. We want serious lessons.
Ah, so
they were the first
class,
1961.
Amazing.
And my dad helped me, and on stage it was too much because I had these children, babies as well. And he encouraged me. He said, and that's where work ethic comes in.
Yeah.
I had a little bit of help in the home then.
Yeah.
And then I persevered, and then in the end it became, it's just a natural result of my Chinese-Australian heritage, I guess, that it, I was just expressing myself.
Yeah, and through food.
And then I found out that they loved it. Everybody loved it so much. They loved the classes so much.
Well, you take quite personally, don't you, the connections you make with your students, and you know very well how many people have came through your school.
Absolutely, yes.
I think I was reading an interview with you or saw it on TV that you were talking about specifically about one young man who, you know, could only cook chops for himself. Mm. And he came to your school and then all of a sudden he was able to invite friends over because he knew how to cook.
I changed his life.
Yeah.
I changed his life for him. And another, I think I even dedicated one book to him.
Did you?
Because he said, I cook for myself and your recipes are for families. Mm. And this one was called Tiny Delights, and so I was thinking of he was a truck driver in between the states.
Yeah.
And when he came back to Melbourne then, he said he couldn't wait to get into his Chinese cooking, and it was lovely. And then he was able to bring his sister into it. He said he was scared first, but then he started to entertain, and he couldn't wait to get back to cook.
That's beautiful.
And I thought that's a beautiful story, you know.
And I see in you, Elizabeth, just the look in your eyes when I mentioned that, the students that have come through your school, and it's very personal to you. I see the change in your demeanour. You really think that you feel those students.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the reason why the school has had such a long.
It's important to you to change people's lives, though. See that.
There was this man, you know, he came and he used to have his eyes closed a fair bit through the classes.
That's not a good sign.
And sometimes they stay behind, you know, to have a little chat with me, and I said, you must have a very stressful job. You seem to be tired.
Yeah.
He said, no, I'm not tired. I close my eyes because I've now exchanged my hypnotherapist for you. He said, instead of going to hypnotherapy for stress, I come and I listen to you and and that gives me much more than going to my hypnotist. Yeah. I think that was wonderful too.
How amazing to have. Did you find, you know, your first group of students came through in the 60s.
Yeah.
Was there any sort of resistance? I mean, back then, you know, we weren't as accepting as a country of Chinese immigrants and that sort of thing. Was there any resistance?
Not from the Australian side, but a little bit on the Chinese side, would you believe?
In terms of sharing the culture. Right.
They thought I would be taking away from their businesses by teaching Australians how to cook. It took away that mystique, you know, that they would never even try.
Yes.
Now I'm telling them it's easy.
Yeah.
And you can do it.
Yeah.
And my father, who was a wide-thinking man, he would go to them and he'd say, no, Elizabeth's doing the opposite.
Yeah, it'll work for
what
you.
What she's doing is widening their appreciation.
Yes.
And your business will flourish because she's kind of like spreading the gospel more or less for you.
Yep, yep. Mm. Just on Dad, I know we've talked about the fact that he invented the dim sim, but how did that happen?
I think being a natural businessman, he could always spot a little marketing niche somewhere. Mm. But he was also a man who loved to do community work, and he if he could, he'd combine philanthropy with business acumen. And he had a lot of older, elderly Chinese men who were kind of remnants from the goldfield days, who were too frail now to work physically. Mm-hmm. And they'd come to Dad for support. And he would think, what I can do is he had a factory. I can make these dim sims that everybody loves so much.
Was it a derivative of the dim sum?
It's a derivative of the little flower pot one called siomai.
Yeah.
But to cater for Australian appetite, it had to be big.
Make it bigger.
The pastry had
How
to
embarrassing.
Be big. And they had to be frozen too, you know, so they had to withstand transportation and so on. But Dad could see that the Australians really loved these dim sims that they could buy. So he didn't really invent it. Mm. It was already there.
But he made it a household name.
His household names. Yeah. And he had these elderly men in mind who could sell them in caravans. Mm-hmm. And they were able to make a living, so they went to the races and to the football and Essendon Airport, I remember.
And
used to
thank
sell them
God for those men.
That's right. And, you know, and so he gave them work to do, and he, you know, the dim sim eventually then, they were all made by hand in those days in the 60s, and then he was the first to have someone create or invent a machine.
And they would have all been steamed then?
Always. They got into the fish and chip shops.
How do you feel about them being fried? Are you okay?
I'm all right with that. If they like them fried, but they're not. I don't eat them fried.
No.
But I have. Yes. And they're okay.
Yeah, they're okay. But you prefer steamed.
Yes.
And you were soy sauce?
Yes. Yeah. Soy sauce is really the only only sauce to go with them.
Yeah, to go with the dip.
But you can see how the fish and chip shops, it's so normal to put them in the basket.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So that's become an Australian.
Yes.
I'm not going to call it an aberration. It's an Australian version. That's okay.
It's incredible. There's so many people listening right now who would just hero worship your dad for making them so accessible.
Do you know my grandchildren still love the commercial one?
They
go out and buy them. I said, oh, you shouldn't be doing that. You should, you know. They're really commercial, but they like them.
Obviously there was a family business when you were younger and dad's business. Did you help out?
No.
No, you were separated.
No, my mother did though.
Yeah.
I can see her sitting there doing hundreds at a time. And he also started the first bean sprout factory, and I can remember her doing all the bean sprout. He was also chicken roll king and the peanut king.
Oh, he is a busy man.
My mum was always there. I was at school playing basketball and being an Aussie kid.
Wow, absolutely beautiful. Well, don't go anywhere. I'm Laura Turner and you're listening to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. There is more to come with the Empress of Chinatown, Elizabeth Chong, when we return.
You're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Great to have your company on Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner, and tonight we've been talking with Elizabeth Chong, who's a regular on Australian TV, an author of books including her much-loved The Heritage of Chinese Cooking. Elizabeth, we've talked all about you coming to Australia, your family business here, love of food and cooking. Your arrival in Australia, though, and then, you know, going to school, way back when. Do you remember those days, and do you remember it being difficult for you as a Chinese girl, I suppose, coming
That's
into
right.
an Aussie school?
Yeah, I do remember those early days of primary school. West Melbourne, it was called King Street State School. Mm-hmm. We lived nearby there. Mm. We were the only Chinese, my family and another Chinese family, we were the only Chinese kids. I do remember Ching Chong Chinaman as a kind of song, you know,
jingle, and then
thing. But I might have been thick-skinned because I don't remember ever being really, really hurt or traumatized. I think just I have a natural, and I think my brothers and sisters sort of naturally sort of cheerful people, and it didn't really worry us. But Laura, think about it. We spoke English like everybody else.
Yes.
If we had come from a country and we didn't have the language when we first went to school, I think that is what divides
people.
The
big barrier. It's
the speech.
Yeah.
And before long, I think they forgot I was Chinese, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and I was just a kid at school. So I can't say I really felt any discrimination, except good stuff. I know the teacher used to, I don't know why the Chinese consul used to come to the school every now and again, but I remember being singled out. And reciting poetry and so forth. And I don't know whether it's because I was a Chinese child that I was different. But then, no, I think I was always happy. I was happy at school. And then I felt it again when I went to secondary school. I went to PLC. It's a pretty establishment sort of a school.
Mm.
And I think the first term at school in Form 1, I felt that I looked different and people saw me as somebody.
You're becoming
different.
A bit more aware of how you looked.
Yeah, I was at,
too.
It's probably about 11 or 12 then. And I remember not liking that.
Mm.
And I remember also when my mum and dad would come to the school sometimes to pick me up, I would be a little bit embarrassed, and I shouldn't say it, but I was probably ashamed that my mother was only speaking Chinese to me.
Right.
And I'd say, speak quietly, Mum, they can hear you speaking Chinese. And so they never actually were a part of the school in the way other children's parents were, because they didn't understand it.
Yeah.
So they weren't there, you know, at sports days and things like that. And I knew that. That made me
You're
different.
You're aware, yeah.
And then more importantly, I think by the time I was in Form 6 or...
That's year 12, isn't it?
No, year...
Or year 11.
No, I'm now 15 or 16 now.
Okay, yeah.
And it's the first school dance.
Yep.
And the boarders from Scotch College were a part of the partners, you know, of the girls.
Mm-hmm.
And they would hold dance in the gymnasium hall, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sitting there all night and I didn't get one dance.
Oh.
And I thought, I made that unattractive.
Oh, that's hard to cope with, yeah.
And then I realise afterwards now, and after, you know, when you sort of think back, it's only because they were a bit nervous.
Yes, yes.
To see a Chinese girl looking different, and they probably thought I couldn't speak a word to them, or maybe I had too...
And even then, I mean, when as teenagers, you don't want to step outside the realms of what everybody else is
doing.
That's right.
So I remember thinking, oh, God, I wish I were not Chinese. Oh. I wish I had, you know, the fair hair and looked like everybody else. Things, just the odd time like that. But then my school life generally was very, very happy. And I did well enough at school to be a good part of the school life, you know. Matter of fact, I ended my school life many, many years later being asked to be the speaker at the speech night.
Well, there you go.
There you go. I couldn't believe that. And I looked out there and in the National Gallery and so many Chinese faces.
Yeah, I'll bet.
And we were the only family then.
Oh, that's
just
amazing.
The only Chinese.
Your husband, Norm, this is many years
you
later.
Have done your research.
Where does he come into the picture? How did you meet Norm?
There is a sporting club here in Melbourne called the Young Chinese League.
Mm-hmm.
And we played tennis.
Yep.
And my brother played football with the Young Chinese League. And everybody's fairly young. And I met him there. And he came down from Bairnsdale because he's born an ABC. He didn't speak Chinese at all.
Right. Okay. Was there any sort of push to have you marry a Chinese-speaking Chinese boy?
No push, but I think that secretly my parents would have hoped I would. My elder sister married John Leong, who his father was the Methodist minister in Little Bourke Street, and he spoke the same dialect. He spoke Chinese, and so he became very close to my parents because he called them mum and dad. But my husband and my sister married his brother too, so two sisters married two brothers.
Did you get married on the same day?
Yes. We did everything together.
How did that
Irene
go? Were you okay with that?
Sharing it was terrific. Yeah. It was fantastic. They were really Bairnsdale country boys, and their mother was only half Chinese.
Okay.
So they didn't really have a Chinese background.
Yep.
And therefore that made a distance between my husband and my parents, and I would have to translate.
Right.
So they never felt close.
Yes. Mm. So you meet Norm, you go on to have four children, and it's sort of then that you're married and having children that you start really cooking.
Yes.
And this is what we know and love you so well for, the Australian public, obviously. How does your TV career take up from there? Because as we know, those who watched GMA with Bert Newton, you were so well known on there and loved. How did that happen?
Yeah, sometimes I get the odd person who wants me to give them an idea how to get on television. I said, I can't tell you that. As you can imagine, my students represented a very large, what would you call it, diversity of people.
Yeah.
And on this occasion, there was a girl who worked in the administrative offices of Channel 10.
Uh-huh. Okay, so she saw your potential.
She said that, I want to introduce you to, I'll get his name later on, and he was, you know, had a top position at Channel 10. I think you should be on television.
Right.
I said, no. And so I kept this appointment, and the next thing, next week, I'm on Good Morning Melbourne with Annette Allison and Roy Hampson.
Wow, and it just went out of control from there.
Yeah.
I was watching an episode of it the other day on YouTube, where you find them now, and you were cooking part of a bull. A bull's appendage. Whose idea was that?
I think it might have been mine, but probably that would have been with Bert, would it be?
Yes, yeah. Well, Bert had quite a stony face throughout it. He was sort of thinking, what is going on here?
Well, my producer must have thought it would be a hoot.
Yeah, yes, yeah.
And so I did it.
Yeah.
But at the start, when I worked with Bert, Bert didn't even know what a capsicum was.
Right.
He was a meat and three veg man, and he didn't even know
Quintessential Aussies.
A long time ago
through.
That was, yes. And so Good Morning Melbourne then moved into Good Morning GMA. Australia.
Yeah, mm. You must have wonderful memories.
Yeah,
of those times. But that was such a relaxed, lovely show, wasn't it?
I enjoyed that very much, and I think Bert and I had a pretty easy rapport, and I enjoyed him. Yes, it was good.
Yes, he's a lovely. He's a jewel in the crown of Australian television.
Yes, he certainly is, and he knew my father because he and Patty courted in his restaurant.
I saw that.
So
actually,
I think he had that extra little spot for me for that, and you know.
The name of your dad's restaurant.
It was Golden Phoenix.
That's right. Yes, and that's where Patty and he would.
Yeah,
court.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Were you nervous that first time going?
Not Good Morning Australia, but in Good Morning Melbourne with Annette. That was early 1981, I think. Mm. I remember just sitting there and just waiting for my cue, and there was all these cameras moving around in the studio, and I said to one cameraman, "What do I do? Where do I look?" And he said, "Well, if you don't know, what are you doing here?"
He did not.
And then Annette and Roy were so good. They just came over to the bench and they just said, "Elizabeth, don't worry about anything. You just do what you do."
Yep.
And from then on, I just tried not to be. But that first time, I was petrified.
Oh. Unbelievable. Well, we all remember you from GMA and so many other things as well. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Great Australian Lives. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, visit tobinbrothers.com.au, and there will be more with celebrity chef and cookbook author Elizabeth Chong up next.
You're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. And, of course, Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives every day of the year. Tonight, we are celebrating the life of Elizabeth Chong, who started Melbourne's very first Chinese cooking school in Melbourne. Everything just exploded from there, didn't it, Elizabeth?
Yes, it did.
Now, Chinese cuisine in Australia, there's so many fusions now and different, you know, ways of doing it. Are you comfortable with things being changed up and fusing the two together?
When it's done properly, I'm really, really happy because I think that's progress.
Mm.
And we do live in a global world now where we're not separated as we were. Even China was once separated in little regions, you know, but now it's all open.
Yeah.
So I think the more we interact with each other, the better the understanding of, you know, maybe war could be lessened if we were to mix.
Be a bit more understanding of each other.
A bit more understanding of each other's culture, and food is a great bond, you know, isn't it, between people?
Absolutely, yeah.
And so I think if Chinese cuisine is adopted in many ways, which it has been, I think most of the Western restaurants even have wok and they have soy sauce and they have ginger, you know, in their pantry. And I think it's a good thing because it is, you know, the cultures are intermarrying, you know, and it's great. But if it's done badly, then it upsets
me. Give it a bad name.
When I see it done badly and they have very little appreciation for it then.
The thing I really liked about what you did and still do, Elizabeth, is I noticed a lot of the stuff on TV, you know, there were some episodes I was watching of you doing it in a caravan and this and that, but you make it very adaptable. You'd say, you know, use peanut oil here and a bit of sesame oil, but don't worry if you don't have sesame oil. That's okay. You know, use this. It's sometimes when you see cooking shows and things can get a bit pretentious where you have to have this and that, but you make it very accessible for people.
Well,
and that's important.
That's the point of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
For teaching, for anything, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's so that people can learn and do it. What's the use of me just showing them something they can't do?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's my, I suppose that's my aim in a way, that I'm sharing with them and then they get the joy as well. And honestly, if they have the love, that's what that last card came to me. She said from 1962, this student.
This is
your
student when you got the...
What I remember about you, Elizabeth, is that your attitude towards food was love.
Yeah.
And I think if everybody had that appreciation and respect and love, then we would be better off in every way. And food is a great, it really speaks to everybody.
And what a beautiful way to end the show, because that is, I think that is you in a nutshell, isn't it? And your former student captured that when she sent you a card when you were given Queen's Birthday honours.
Yeah.
And that means so much to you.
It does. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us. It's been a great honour.
Thank you, Laura. It was lovely.
And don't forget to share. If you'd like to share this episode with a friend or would like to catch up on any of our previous shows, subscribe to the podcast and join me again the same time next week when we celebrate another great Australian life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
You're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.